Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. What does the year 2026 have in store for us? How much continuity can we expect from the year that has passed? If there is to be change, what kind of change? On this edition of the program, we gaze into our crystal balls. Okay, discussing the year that has happened, 2026, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And here in Moscow, we cross the Mark Sloboda. He's an international relations and security analyst. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let me go to Mark first. One of the things I pride myself on, and with the podcast that I do with George, is to stay away from predictions, because predictions usually end up with an egg on your face, as it were here. I would approach it in a different way. I would approach it as a theory of the case. How would you build a case about a certain situation moving forward? And since this program has been, we've been absorbed by the conflict in Ukraine for years on this program, what's your case when you're presenting what you think is going to happen with Ukraine in this new year?
First of all, I don't think that there's going to be any diplomatic settlement, at least not that any of us can see thus far. Whatever the Trump administration, the Europeans, the Kiev regime are talking about with each other, not able to come to any agreement with each other, any iteration of it is very far from Russia's own concretely held goals for their special military operation. And now, following up the Kiev regime's attempted assassination of Putin by launching 91 strike drones, which I find very hard to believe could have been done as far from the contact line as Novgorod without Western satellite support for this operation, it having failed. I think that Russia's in no mood for any diplomatic settlement for the Kiev regime. I don't have any indication yet that a regime collapse is imminent, although it must be said that a collapse often comes very suddenly. But I think Russia will continue to make accelerating advances on the ground. I expect that all of Donbass will be secured by Russia by no later than the middle of the year, and Russia will be moving on Zaporozhye and Kharkov and Dnipropetrovsk going into the second half of the year. And those aren't wild predictions. I mean, that it is a fair assessment of the way things are going on the battlefield. The Kiev regime has no ability. The Europeans or the Americans, no matter what they do, what they supply it with, you know, any economic threats that they can make towards Russia have proved toothless. They can't avert the course on the ground. It is all but an inevitability at this point, bar a black swan event. I mean, let's say they had managed to kill Putin. The only thing that would guarantee is that Ukraine would completely cease to exist as a state by whatever Russian leader followed Putin. That is the, you know, it's not what they think it is.
Yeah, I mean, in Georgia, we both know very well predictions only get you into hot water or at the very least you feel embarrassed. But what is your theory of the case? Because I think Mark's really kind of on the money there. He said black swan. That's what I worry about, because in lieu of a negotiated end, you can always we all should be worried about escalation, and I mean really dangerous escalation, like chemical, biological, even worse. Is that in your is that on your bingo card, as it were, George?
Well, I think, Peter, that's a definite possibility. The Russians react in a very measured way. I think that they don't do anything. They don't just go crazy. You know, hey, look, they've attempted to assassinate Putin, or even if they'd succeeded, well, therefore, let's obliterate Ukraine. I just don't think that's the Russian style. They're always very measured in their response. And I think how they'll respond to this will be you know, measured. They're not going to do anything wild or nothing that's out of their strategy. The problem is that I don't think it's going to be resolved in this coming year, because I think even if Russia takes the whole of Donetsk sometime this year and then continues with Kherson and Zaporozhye and in Kharkov and so on, the war will continue. And I think I remember Marx saying once that, you know, even if they take this oblast and that oblast, the war will continue. And then, and I think Mark then further said, and even if they take Kiev, the war will continue. That they will continue with some kind of a guerrilla war out of Poland or, you know, or wherever, as, you know, in a way that they did after 1945. So this war is just going to continue. I think NATO, the EU are absolutely determined to maintain this conflict against Russia. They think that this is a historic opportunity to weaken and fatally, once and for all, destroy Russia. They're not going to let go. You know, they can lose one territory and after another in Ukraine, but they will continue with this war.
Well, you know, Mark, it's interesting because we've all of us on this program and many people that we talk about the fate of NATO, but or its possible demise as a result of this conflict here. But one could make the theory of the case is that this has only emboldened NATO, the European Union, because it no longer pursues prosperity and security. Its entire identity now is anti-Russia. It actually emboldens the EU and NATO.
Yeah. So NATO is a rather interesting because it's without a leader right now, but still going through the motions because Trump has no interest in being the leader of NATO. It's kind of absent a steersman at the helm, and they're kind of on autopilot as far as the European and, you, I guess, you, if you want to include Canada as well, pursuing the conflict in Ukraine, but without having even less capability than they did when they were with the United States, and Russia was still winning, it must be said, in the, you know, the final months of the Blinken Sullivan administration. I think that NATO is going to go through a lot of pains for the next 3 years, but will ultimately survive. And yes, it will have renewed identity. For a while, under Stoltenberg and others, they were starting to talk about the Pacific NATO, yeah, and NATO contributing to a U.S. war on, yeah, China and everything else. That's all been then left, you know, on the cutting room floor, and NATO's, the European part of NATO's actual capabilities when it comes to military, I think it's been a bit of a shock what bad states the NATO military, the European militaries and military industrial complex actually are. So, I mean, they are losing to Russia, much less being able to successfully fight China alongside the U.S. on the other side of the world. So NATO will be used to contain Russia in Europe, such as it is, maybe not as confrontationally as it has, but as long as the conflict in Ukraine continues, there's always the possibility that it will continue past a Trump administration and that the next president will be more willing to walk into it. The Europeans seem convinced that they're going to be directly at war with Russia, and they seem pretty active in that regard by 2030, and Trump will be long gone by then. So the simmering conflict in Ukraine, as George pointed out, will be used to reignite direct conflict with Russia at some point in the future when the Europeans feel better and there's someone else in the White House. Russia is well aware of this. They said as much this year in meetings with the military general staff with Putin in attendance, and they are preparing for it.
Well, George, let's take a look at other parts of the globe right here. Venezuela is very much part of the agenda that the Trump administration is pursuing. We heard at the end of the year with the Netanyahu's, what, fifth or sixth visit to the United States and that year, Iran. So this year is, this new year is shaping up to be just as unstable, if not more violent, than last year.
Yes, I think so. But I think in the case of Venezuela, it seems unlikely that Trump will succeed in this regime change operation. It's not even at all clear why Trump is so preoccupied with affecting this regime change in Caracas. I mean, I don't know what it is Maduro is doing to him that is so infuriating him. Well, I would have thought, you know, he and Maduro could quite easily come to some kind of a modus vivendi. I think Maduro is hardly a card-carrying, wild Marxist-Leninist. He seems a very pragmatic sort of person, socially quite conservative. Venezuela is generally quite a socially conservative. So quite why Trump is engaging in this regime change operation, a very dangerous regime change operation, it's a mystery. And lobbing missiles into Venezuela, and that obviously is coming, has already started with that. That's not going to bring regime change. It never has. It's never worked, just simply attacking a country. All that does is rally the public around the government. So there's unlikely to have any success there. And when it comes to the Middle East, and we have Israel's plans, I mean, obviously Israel has its ambitions with Iran, unfinished business from 2025. I think Trump will probably be very cautious about that. I think he's seen Israel's limited military capabilities, and he sees himself as getting sucked into a very, very unpleasant war with Iran. Iran is a much more formidable adversary than Venezuela. And as I say, he's not going to succeed with Venezuela. But there are midterm elections in the United States, and that could bring political change in Washington, because, of course, if, as is likely, Trump suffers some serious setbacks in the midterms, that's historically always been the case, he has the Democrats now to contend with. They will be absolutely determined to move ahead with a number of impeachments and thereby, you know, bog Trump down into fighting off case after another.
What we might see is Congress trying to initiate a regime change in the White House. Okay, I have to jump in here. We're going to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on 2026. Stay with RT.
Taxes fund the war instead.
It's all because what Putin said.
Bureaucrats are on your back.
It's all because of Putin whack.
Santa robbed your kids this year.
It's all because of Putin dear.
No new hope for year ahead.
It's all because the Putin dread.
It's all because of Putin.
It's all because of Putin.
Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing the year 2026. Okay, let's go back to Mark here in Moscow. We, at the end of the first part of the program, we were talking about Trump's dilemma, I would call it, in dealing with Venezuela. He's got himself into a position where he doesn't want to lose face. He has people surrounding him like the Marco Rubio gang and the Miami Mafia. They really want to move forward. And it's not about Venezuela. It's about Cuba. It's about Nicaragua. It's about a lot of other things. It's about minerals. It's about denying China and Russia influence. This is far more complex than it's just these boats that are being destroyed in the Atlantic and the Caribbean. How will the international community, if we can use that term, usually I use it in a pejorative way, what's the world going to think of this? Okay, what is China going to think of this? What is China and Russia, India think of this?
Does it matter?
Okay.
It doesn't, because this is the Western Hemisphere. And even without a Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, China, Russia, India, you know, whoever, Iran, they simply lack power projection and the ability, you know, a lot of people have outsized abilities. They think that Russia and China could effectively arm Venezuela. We see how hard it is even for the United States to filter its military might through Ukraine. And they have, the Europeans right there. There's very little that Russia, China, and Iran can do. I think mostly what they'll be doing is sitting back and seeing how much of a mess the U.S. can get themselves into, not only militarily in Venezuela, but also the issue of governance and with the rest of the South American countries. But you mentioned China, and I think that is perhaps the big unheralded story that started in 2025 and is a trend that's just going to grow and explode in 2026. The U.S., over the last few years, even before the Trump administration, adapted a policy of tech containment of China. And then Trump opened that up further with a full-on trade war, tariff war initiated against China, trying to force the rest of the world to decouple from China. And China, we find out, has been preparing for this quietly for years. They have monopolized high-tech supply chains around the world with rare earths, but many other important silver and many other important elements that are absolutely necessary. They've replicated Western advances with semiconductors a decade before it was thought they were going to be able to do so. They're capable of it appears, even surpassing the U.S. in AI developments. China is starting to leverage with their confidence in their geo-economic power geopolitically against the United States. We see them sanctioning U.S. military companies, Boeing, Lockheed Martin, the CEOs of these companies, and restricting access of absolutely crucial rare earths, lithium batteries, other elements that the Pentagon, that U.S. high-tech industry needs. China is just going to completely overwhelm the U.S. in this regard. It is a clear sign that 2026, China is going to emerge as the geo-economic power. And let me say for the future, I, for one, welcome our future Chinese overlords.
All right, George, how do you react to that? Because, I mean, you know, these rare earths and other minerals, this is a very key issue here. And they do exist in the Western Hemisphere. And given what Mark just said there, so Trump is just going to take them.
Well, the thing is about the rare earths is that they're not really rare. There's plenty of them around the world. China has indeed monopolized it because actually extracting the rare earths is very environmentally damaging, and nobody really wanted to do it. The Chinese were prepared to do it, and then, lo and behold, they ended up monopolizing it. But, the rest of the world, particularly the United States, having seen this, are unlikely just to sit on their hands and just throw up their hands and say, okay, well, we're just going to accept that China has a global monopoly. So I think that's going to change. I think the United States and others will begin extracting rare earths themselves. And, obviously, yes, China has some economic leverage, maybe a great deal of economic leverage, but so is the United States. I mean, if we're really going to get into a kind of a battle of, China's sanctioning U.S. companies and demanding that, you know, imposing export controls on anything that includes Chinese extracted rare earths, the United States can absolutely turn around and say, well, we're going to ban any exports of material that uses U.S. chips. And so therefore, you know, China, basically, they're not going to get anything that has U.S. chip components in them. I don't think anyone really wants to go down that path. I don't think the United States wants to go down that path. But in principle, that could happen. So it's very dangerous when you start applying this kind of economic pressure because the United States can apply equal amount and a great deal more of pressure. And particularly when we come to the question of the U.S. economy, which the Chinese economy does depend on access to the U.S. market. And if suddenly that was, you know, if China was excluded from that, that would indeed cause very, very serious problems for China.
You know, Mark, I mean, the hallmark of American foreign policy for 80 years after the Second World War is that because of its economic and military might, first of all, one of the principles is not to go to war with the Soviet Union, which we avoided, okay, and that was good here. But now we have a situation where the United States faces real peer competition. China is the most important example of that. Can the United States manage that without its continued drive for hegemony?
Yeah, I first of all, I have to disagree with George. China has actually has diversified its exports to an incredible degree in just the last 5 years. And the United States is down to something like 10% of Chinese exports at this point. I mean, the biggest destination of Chinese products is China's own domestic market. First of all, they've managed to build up a very, you know, in global terms, wealthy and economically driven population capable of supplying consumption needs all on their own, plus diversification with Southeast Asia, even Africa, South America, and the Europeans. The end all be all is right now the U.S. economically needs China far more than China needs the United States. And that is why we saw the about face by the Trump administration over the trade wars that they initiated with China. And all of that has just been pushed back for a year. None of that is settled yet, right? That is all going to reemerge in this next year. And I think the U.S., I mean, it's very easy to talk about mining rare earths. It's not the mining, it's the refining, right? That is an industry that the U.S. completely lacks. It is extremely intensive. It requires a lot of infrastructure, a very high-skilled, high-tech labor force that the U.S. simply completely lacks. They are not going to have a solution to the rare earths and et cetera, because there's a number of other elements there, for a decade or more. It's going to be a huge problem for them. And increasingly, I think China is going to leverage it on Taiwan, because the U.S., you know, seems to be spitting in China's face with these ever-increasing arms supplies to the separatists in Taiwan. And China just initiated a blockade of Taiwan with Coast Guard naval exercises. And the U.S. right now appears to be kind of like a deer caught in the headlights. They don't know where to go. They initiated Japan into adopting a new hawkish policy on China. And then when they did so, China reacted so negatively to it, calling up and reading the riot act to Trump, that he had to call the new Japanese prime minister, Takeuchi, and tell her to dial it down. The Chinese just bent us over the barrel on trade. We can't reinitiate this with them. So I respectfully have to completely disagree with George. I think China's in the driver's seat geoeconomically. And we know that military power with just a very limited lag follows economic power. And we're emerging into a Chinese drone, naval, and air dominance of their side of the Pacific, probably within 5 years.
Well, George, we have 1 minute left here. Or maybe Trump will recognize China as being of the peer that it is and come to some kind of compromise. George.
Well, I think Trump is already doing that. Of course, he is going to visit China early in 2026. And then there is also a promise from President Xi to visit the United States, I think, either later in 2026 or in 2027. So, and you could even see from the national security strategy document that there was really very little belligerence towards China. When it came to the subject of Taiwan, the document said, you know, we're in favor of preserving the status quo. No changes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, George, that's what, again, going back to this national security strategy, we went through it with a fine-tooth comb, and then there's the biggest arms sales to Taiwan in history. Trying to square the circle. Gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to wish both of you a very, very happy new year. Of course, I'm going to see both of you all through this new year of 2026. So I want to thank my guests in Budapest and here in Moscow. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.